Mark Gregory looks at what became of the billions of American and Iraqi dollars earmarked for the country's reconstruction following the invasion.
I think we're looking at a huge scandal. We don't know who got that money.
I felt that it was the most blatant disregard for procedures.
There was the corruption, there was mismanagement, there was waste, there was fraud, there was abuse, there was incompetence. The list goes on and on.
There it is. 25 years of hatred and rage as they jump up on the statue, trouncing it with anything.
The statue fell in April 2003. Iraq was in a mess, despite its oil wealth. Decades of conflict and sanctions had wrecked the infrastructure of roads, power stations and schools. President Bush announced the war was over and promised that America would help rebuild.
Now that the dictator is gone, we and our coalition partners are helping Iraqis to lay the foundations of a free economy.
Since that pledge was made, America has spent $36 billion of its own money on reconstruction. More controversially, the U.S. has also spent $20 billion of Iraqi cash. This $20 billion was in the Development Fund for Iraq, set up by the U.N. just as the war ended. All revenue from Iraqi oil went into that fund. It was supposed to kickstart the economy in the post-war chaos.
Gentleman's recognized for 12 minutes.
Mr. Speaker, today I will focus on the reconstruction effort in Iraq and the massive waste, fraud, and abuse that have undermined our efforts. The reconstruction gap, which is the chasm between the president's promises and reality.
In hearings on Capitol Hill here in Washington, Congressman Henry Waxman has emerged as the most vocal critic of America's record on reconstruction. In particular, Waxman claims proper accounting procedures were ignored when large sums of Iraqi cash were handed over by the Coalition Provisional Authority, the American-led body that ran the country immediately after the war, to get Iraqi ministries functioning again.
I think we're looking at a huge scandal. The CPA handed over $8.8 billion in cash to the Iraqi government, even though that new government had no security or accounting system in place to handle the cash. No one can account for it. We don't know who got that money.
So a lot of that money was stolen, misused?
Absolutely.
I'm in a taxi driving across Washington to meet a man with a splendid job title. Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. His task is to follow the paper trail. And after more than 100 investigations, his work paints a grim picture of waste and mismanagement. He reports to Congress, but was chosen by the White House, and is a most unlikely critic. He's a Republican, comes from Texas, and was an associate and staunch ally of President Bush. That was before he took this job. I'm going to ask Stuart Bowen what he knows about the Iraqi money under U.S. management, the $20 billion in total, $8.8 billion of which was passed to Iraqi ministries.
It was a massive cash management program. Billions, literally, of dollars, shrink-wrapped in plastic, were flown out of Andrews Air Force Base near here on these night flights on C-17s to Baghdad International Airport. $2 billion a flight. And I know of at least six flights.
So $2 billion
per flight. $2 billion. Those are huge pallets.
Where did the money go? Well, Stuart Bowen thinks some of it went to pay the salaries of thousands of Iraqi civil servants who weren't actually on the payroll.
Lots and lots of salaries were paid to people who didn't exist. Ghost employees is the term of art, and that was known.
So the problem was a failure to establish accountability, transparency, and auditing at the outset.
Exactly right. That's an enormous lesson learned from the overall Iraq experience. Oversight early is essential.
As the planes landed with their hefty bundles of greenbacks, the money became the responsibility of a man named David Oliver. A former nuclear submarine commander, Oliver was in Baghdad in the summer of 2003 as the coalition authority's first head of finance. He helped establish the financial framework, but resisted pressure to bring in outside auditors. He's giving the BBC his first ever broadcast interview. As head of finance at the time, surely he must know what happened to that $8.8 billion.
I have no idea. I can't tell you whether or not the money went to the right things or didn't. Nor do I actually think it's important.
Not important?
No. The coalition, I think it was between 300 and 600 people, civilians. And you want to bring in 3,000 auditors to make sure that money's being spent? I thought that I would accept the British-trained auditors they had.
Yes, but the fact is that billions of dollars have disappeared without trace.
Of their money. Billions of dollars of their money disappeared without trace. Yeah, I'm saying what difference does it make?
That may seem an astonishingly complacent statement, but it made no difference to David Oliver because he felt there were more pressing priorities.
You had infants that were dying when you lost power because premature babies were dying in the ICUs and hospitals because they had no backup power. I chose to give that money to the Iraqis. They got in contract and got the backup power working within 8 days in the major hospitals in Baghdad. If I had followed U.S. procurement procedures and audit procedures, you'd had to put out bids for 30 or 40 days before you even started looking at it.
So your view was it was far more important to save lives, to get things done, than worry about accounting procedures.
That's absolutely right. And we have to remember, this is Iraqi money. It was their money.
But you don't know what happened to that money. You don't know whether it was used wisely, or whether it was all stolen.
That's right. You have no idea. And the question is whether or not you set up a system to do that on top of this. And I chose not to.
Was that a right decision?
Absolutely.
I arrived and asked for the plan to find that there wasn't one.
Andy Bierpark, a blunt-speaking Englishman, was in charge of infrastructure and development at the CPA, the body that ran Iraq. It was his job to supervise reconstruction, and he was well qualified. He'd done a similar job in Kosovo. But never in a career spent in difficult conditions had he come across such a lack of preparation.
The plan had to be created at the same time as it was being implemented. Everything to do with the CPA was being invented from scratch, from a zero base.
It didn't have to be that way. In Washington, the State Department had drawn up extensive plans for post-war reconstruction. But they fell by the wayside after a bureaucratic turf war with the Pentagon. The pre-war planners had anticipated a mass refugee disaster in Iraq. As it turned out, that was about the only crisis they didn't have to deal with.
The planning that had been done had probably been done for the wrong eventuality. It had been done on the basis of a humanitarian crisis of large-scale population flows, and they never took place.
But what did take place was looting, on a breathtaking scale.
When people think of the looting, they think of people breaking shop windows and stealing the TV sets. It wasn't like this. This was looting on a scale that had never, ever been seen before, certainly by me anywhere in the world.
Give me an example. What do you mean?
About a week after I arrived, I went down to the main sewage pumping plant that was meant to service all of Baghdad. I got there with my Iraqi interlocutors, and I just stood there and I said, but I thought we were going to visit the sewage pumping station because all I could see was a warehouse. And they said, you're here. But there was nothing. And I don't mean there was very little. There was nothing. There were just a few holes in the ground where once bolts had gone that held the pumps that filtered the water.
In this atmosphere of improvisation and chaos, it's perhaps not surprising that accounting procedures took a back seat. CPA officials were making things up as they went along. Andy Bierpark recalls a startling case in point. Bierpark's boss, the head of the CPA, was an urbane, if rather aloof, career diplomat, Paul Bremer. Not long after arriving in Baghdad, Bremer handed Bierpark a huge dossier on the long-term rebuilding of Iraq. It had been drawn up by the giant American construction company, Bechtel.
The Bechtel engineers went throughout Iraq, giving an estimate of what they thought would be required for the reconstruction of Iraq. The figure they came up with was about $20 billion. But these things were being done just amazingly quickly. The time pressure was something I'd never, ever experienced before. I mean, I remember being given that Bechtel assessment, 7 ring folders, you know, 3 feet of paper, and having something like 3 hours to say, is this a good idea or a bad idea?
So 3 hours to come to a decision about nearly $20 billion worth of spending.
That's my recollection, yes.
How money was accounted for depended on where it came from. Taxpayer-funded American aid programs came with far tougher stipulations than Iraqi money under US control from the Development Fund for Iraq. T. Christian Miller, an investigative reporter, has written a book about Iraq reconstruction, Blood Money.
Yes, they were very different. The US explicitly wanted to set up a system where they could get their hands on some easy money, and that easy money was Iraqi money. So what they did is they created 2 separate standards of spending. One was the U.S. regulations, and the second was the Iraqi regulations, which they wrote themselves that first summer in 2003 under Jerry Bremer. If you're going to spend U.S. money, you had a 1,900-page booklet of regulations you had to follow. On the other hand, if you wanted to spend Iraqi money, you only had to follow a 12-page-long book of regulations, which guaranteed that it was a lot easier to spend the Iraqi money.
So that Iraqi money, as well as being easier to handle, it was also easier to abuse.
Absolutely. Most of the corruption scandals you've seen come out of Iraq have stemmed from the Iraqi money, not from the U.S. money. The Iraqi money was spent willy-nilly.
But while most of the corruption allegations center around the Iraqi money, the financial chaos also extended to projects financed by U.S. taxpayers.
I had never been in a war zone, and when we came
in, 2 early contracts to Bechtel and Halliburton have aroused the greatest controversy because they appeared to bypass the normal rules. In a sign of how defensive some large contractors have become, Bechtel has just released a glossy corporate video on its record in Iraq.
Mountains of deserts and marshes, as tough and determined as its people have to be in order to get a living from it.
Both Bechtel and Halliburton were awarded their first contracts in Iraq without having to bid for them.
I'm Bernadine Hayes Greenhouse, and I'm the principal assistant responsible for contracting, the former principal assistant responsible for contracting for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Bunny Greenhouse objected to contracts giving work to various Halliburton subsidiaries. Halliburton is a military contractor and also carries out oil repairs. Dick Cheney was its chief executive before he became U.S. vice president. The Halliburton contracts involved support services for U.S. troops and distributing fuel throughout Iraq.
I felt that it was the most blatant disregard for procedures. It came to my office as a no-bid contract. And that concerned me, first of all, that I had to look at the justification for that. There are other companies that could possibly have provided the same mission accomplishment for us.
How quickly could you have organized a bid?
We don't need 30 days to do a bid. We don't need even days. All we need is 2 or more companies that are capable of doing the job, and it can be done in hours.
Whistleblowers are rarely popular. Bunny Greenhouse ended up being demoted to a less sensitive job.
I brought to the attention of the leadership, the kinds of improprieties that were going on in contracting, and as a result of that, I was fired. I believe that integrity in government is not an option, it's an obligation. And if that's what I got fired for, so be it.
So what have we got? Allegations of impropriety in the awarding of contracts in the U.S., chaos at the occupation authority that ran post-war Iraq, and large sums of Iraqi oil money disappearing, apparently without any record of how it was spent, and this on America's watch. Critics of U.S. policy in Iraq believe part of the problem was incompetent management by the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S.-led occupation body. Democrat Congressman Henry Waxman says politics are to blame.
Absolutely, because the Coalition Provisional Authority was made up of people whose test to be there was that they were good Republicans.
political appointees, political hacks. They were asked questions not whether they spoke Arabic, they were asked not whether they knew anything about development, they were asked whether they voted for George Bush in 2000, what their views were on abortion. That was more important than whether they could do the job.
Maybe it's not surprising that a liberal-leaning Democrat politician blames the problems on the political opposition. More telling are the views of someone who knew the coalition authority from the inside, David Oliver, the first head of finance. He delivers a damning indictment on the quality of US personnel. But he doesn't think it matters much that they were Republicans.
That's the wrong criticism. It isn't that they were Republicans, it's that they were not qualified.
They weren't qualified?
No. Terribly poorly qualified. The problem was there wasn't enough talent. They essentially were people who were willing to drop whatever they were doing and go to Iraq. So you've had very few people who had successful businesses or were senior people who would drop everything in their career and go to Iraq for a chance to get killed. I mean, you have to be not very bright to volunteer for that.
Whether they were bright or not so bright, the staff of the CPA were in charge for a year or so after the war. To finance reconstruction, they drew mainly on Iraqi oil money, along with just a few billion dollars of aid from the US government. The bulk of the American taxpayer-funded aid actually came later, after the return of sovereignty to Iraqis, when a massive $18 billion reconstruction package approved by the U.S. Congress started to kick in.
This is one of the largest non-military budget requests in American history. It amounts to more than 10 times more than the United States has ever spent in a year in any country.
That was Paul Bremer, then head of the U.S. administration in Iraq, speaking at the time. He offered a vision of a country in which the lights worked and clean water flowed from the taps. But 2.5 years after the handover, many Iraqis say their lives are getting worse, despite the vast sums spent on rebuilding.
Reconstruction after war? No. No any reconstruction. No. The electric, water, no anything.
How many hours electricity has in your house?
3 hours. Or 4 hours, someday no hours.
Do you see any reconstruction signs now in Iraq?
No. Just the terrorist operation in Iraq now.
Are you joking?
What's the electricity? The whole world, you know, enjoy electricity, enjoy the benefits of electricity, but here in Iraq we miss this. I think you can go to the Iraqi and American officials and ask them, where did they spend this money? I don't know.
Baghdad resident speaking to an Iraqi reporter. Their mood of gloom is borne out by the statistics. Power output is barely above the pre-war level, despite massive investment. The same is true of oil exports. But the man who initially ran the main U.S. reconstruction program is unapologetic.
Had I to do it all over again, faced with the same things we were faced with, I would do it exactly the way I did it last time.
David Nash arrived in Baghdad in late 2003. He had been an admiral in the U.S. Navy, building and maintaining naval bases. In Iraq, it was his job to set up and manage $18.4 billion of U.S. reconstruction aid. This was not the only American money spent on reconstruction, but it was the main element. The money started arriving as sovereignty was given back to Iraqis. Now, Nash says it was never going to be enough to complete the task.
From the very beginning, we knew that the World Bank had estimated it would cost around $60 billion to rebuild the infrastructure. So we knew $18.4 billion wasn't going to solve a $50 or a $60 or a $100 billion problem. So, no, nobody ever that worked with me ever thought we were going to fix the infrastructure of Iraq because it was, number one, in very bad shape because it had been neglected for 30 years. Number two, it was severely impacted by the burning and looting that occurred. And then thirdly, where we thought we were going to build in a benign environment, we ended up building under fire.
As the rebuilding program got underway, the security situation became worse and costs rose. We've been told that half the money allocated for reconstruction was ultimately eaten up in direct and indirect security expenses. A distinctive feature of the $18 billion program was the way in which work was parcelled up. A small number of huge companies, such as Bechtel, Halliburton, Parsons, and Washington International, were awarded huge contracts. Almost everything was contracted out to private firms. There was a logic, at least according to David Nash.
The idea was that in Iraq there were no large contractors who could take on this kind of work. So if you're going to conduct a large infrastructure program, you need to bring in people that know how to do it and how to manage large programs.
So your plan was to bring in big companies and knew how to do this stuff?
I wanted to bring in people that had the capability to do it, and often that's found in large international companies.
But were large Western firms the best choice for the job? To find out, I've come to a trade fair in Erbil in northern Iraq. It's the one part of Iraq that's reasonably safe to visit, and indeed, it even shows signs of thriving. Most of the businesses here are Iraqi, but there's a smattering of US companies involved in rebuilding. Cameron Wolf is operations director for a small American engineering company with reconstruction contracts in Baghdad. He's watched the big corporations come in and fail.
I think one of the biggest problems that came in is a lot of the large prime contractors. They came in with the mindset of, here's how we're going to do it. This is the way we do it in the West. Where I think they failed was they didn't embrace the Iraqi people, the Iraqi engineers, and say, okay, this is your country. How do you do it? They never got out to see what was really going on because they couldn't. They weren't allowed to travel. It was definitely a bunker mentality. They honestly think the world ends when you walk outside the green zone or you're going to get shot.
And the big Western firms, they tended to rely on expensive expat staff. So surely it must have cost an awful lot to get things done.
When I first came to Baghdad, I think the average worker, most of them were making around $600 to $700 a month. That was a good salary for an Iraqi engineer. That's not a lot of money when you look at what some of the salaries are being paid to Western engineers, whether it be American or British.
And what kind of salaries are they being paid?
Anywhere from $100,000 to $250,000 a year type salaries out there, for depending on what their skill set is.
I'm trying to do the maths in my head, so it can be a function of being paid 50 times as much, the Westerner than the Iraqi.
Correct.
Who could do the same job.
Correct.
But companies with the main contract often haven't done the actual work. That's passed on to subcontractors, who in turn pass on all or part of the job to others. We've discovered that with reconstruction contracts, there were often 7, 8, or even 9 links in the chain, with profit being taken at every stage. I spoke to Faris El Musli, a regional head of the Iraqi American Chamber of Commerce. So it's big American companies getting the contracts, but Iraq is doing the work.
Most of them. Yeah. The Iraqis now complain. They say why sometimes the officials inside Iraq sign the contracts with big companies like Americans, and then the work will be doing from Iraqi companies. So why we could direct sign the contracts?
Who gets most of the profit?
Of course, the first one, the main contractor.
This must be very frustrating for the Iraqi companies.
Yeah, and they are taking the risk. They are doing a very hard and good job. And in the end, that they will get very small profit for this job.
So it's been a bit of a rip-off.
Yeah.
There are legions of stories about reconstruction contracts that went wrong. For example, Parsons, a Californian firm, had a $900 million contract to build new courts and prisons throughout Iraq. But the project was a disaster, according to Congressman Henry Waxman, a leading critic of the rebuilding effort.
Parsons built the Baghdad Police College, $72 million to build. This is a place where we're going to train police. Well, our government auditors found that the contractor's work and the administration's oversight were so grossly deficient that urine and fecal matter were literally raining down on Iraqi police recruits. The toilets were leaking, the place stunk, and this is where we were trying to train Iraqi police. This became the lens through which the Iraqis now see America. Incompetence, profiteering, arrogance, and human waste oozing out of the ceilings as a result.
Parsons gave us this response.
As an engineering and construction company with a history of delivering superior program management and top quality projects, Parsons regrets that problems with the new Baghdad Police College occurred after the facility was turned over to the US government and put in use by Iraqi trainees. While we acknowledge our responsibility as the prime contractor on the facility's renovation, working in a war zone poses unique challenges.
The American reconstruction effort may have run into the sands of the Iraqi desert, but now more and more of the key decisions are being made by Iraqis. This is a well-known Iraqi kebab restaurant called Ghazim Abul Qas. It's a favorite hangout for Iraqis, but I'm not actually in Iraq. This is the Jordanian capital, Amman. There's a large Iraqi community here. It includes many of Iraq's business elite. Thousands of rich, educated Iraqis have fled to Jordan to escape the violence. They also complain of another huge problem they face back home: corruption within government.
Corruption is endemic. There's corruption at every single level.
How does it work? What do you have to do to get the contract?
Well, you have to pay in advance to every single level in the ministries.
Ali Demirji is a wealthy Iraqi exile living in Amman. He still owns a chain of 12 shops in Iraq, but has given up plans to bid for government reconstruction contracts. He says officials demand too much in bribes.
At every single level, you pay someone, and that does not mean that you get the job. It just means you get an entree into the contract tender, and it might happen, it might not.
How much do you have to pay?
A $3 million contract, you'd have to pay something like $1.5 million.
To get $3 million of work, you have to pay out $1.5 million in bribes.
In bribes, yes. On some contracts, yes. I've never seen corruption this way.
So you've done business in many countries around the world, and you've never seen corruption on the scale that's encountered in Iraq?
No, I haven't, no.
This combination of violence and corruption has completely crippled economic development, he says. But has he seen any evidence of reconstruction?
No, I mean, there isn't a crane in Baghdad to be seen, construction crane in Baghdad. So what is reconstruction? If there aren't any cranes, then there's no reconstruction.
So what about all that money then? What's happened to it? It goes into somebody's back pocket.
What do you think? I mean, I ask you, what do you think?
Corruption has been fueled by the constant flux of Iraqi politics. Three different governments have held office since the handback of sovereignty, each one with a new set of ministers and officials, all of whom know they won't be around long. T. Christian Miller, investigative reporter for the LA Times, says it's been a recipe for graft.
Oh yeah, there's been a long line of Iraqi ministers, former ministers, leaving Iraq who are believed to have left with bags of cash and stashed them away in real estate in places like Knightsbridge in London, in fancy condominiums in the United Arab Emirates, in mansions in Jordan. So a lot of money has gone missing and nobody's certain where.
But it's been a kind of revolving door of different governments. And is that part of it, the fact that governments are only in power for quite a brief period of time, so people have a window of opportunity?
Yeah, certainly. Each Iraqi government that has come in has taken their own pound of flesh. They've come into office, they know they've got a short time span there, 6 months until the next election comes around, and so they see it essentially as an invitation to steal the place blind while they have the opportunity to do that.
And in your view, the explanation for that, is that rooted in the easy money, the huge billions being thrown about in the early days after the war?
Oh, sure. Iraq was the Wild West. So a lot of the Iraqis who went in there were looking in to cash in, and they did. Iraq was like a giant ATM for a lot of people. You could go in, do your time, withdraw your cash, and leave, and there would be no record of what you'd done.
Oil is one of the main sources of corruption in Iraq. Revenue that could rebuild the country is being lost to theft on an epic scale. When US technicians renovated the pipes and wells after the war, they failed to install proper metering. So nobody knows how much crude should be in the system, which means it's easy to steal. Issam Chalabi was an oil minister under Saddam Hussein. He says the Americans fail to install meters, even at the offshore terminal that handles all Iraq's crude exports.
Was it difficult to install metering at the terminal, which is 50 kilometers away? It's got nothing to do with security. This is 50 kilometers away from Iraq, in the Gulf. It took us no more than 2 years to build the terminal itself. And you tell me that up till this very minute they cannot install metering system?
Why haven't they installed this metering?
I wish somebody could give me the answer. Is it that expensive? $1 million? $5 million? Damn it, I mean, you can go and even pay double the price and install those meters in no time. And here we are talking about millions and billions of dollars. Iraq wouldn't be in need of handouts from anybody. Iraq would have been able to stand on its feet, rebuild its country, rebuild all the infrastructure, and get everything right.
So why didn't the Americans install oil meters in the pipes? David Nash, the man in charge of the $18 billion reconstruction program.
I think that was an issue, and probably it should have been done. But there were so many things to do, one has to come up with priorities. It wasn't just because there weren't meters there is the reason that oil was a problem. There were lots of problems.
But given that 90% of Iraqi government revenue comes from oil, you'd have thought that establishing a proper metering system was a pretty crucial priority.
Well, it doesn't do any good to have a proper metering system if the pipeline is not operating. It doesn't do any good to have a proper metering system if the oil fields are reduced in their ability to produce. Metering is just one of the issues.
It's easy to run away with the idea that everything in Iraq is hopeless, that there's nothing but gloom, doom, violence and corruption. But from this trade fair in northern Iraq, I'm hearing a different story. Businessmen from Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq say they're optimistic about the future, and they sound almost convincing.
Who are you? Zaid Mehdi, Business Development Director, Trade Bank of Iraq. We are very pleased to announce that we are the first Iraqi bank that has put an ATM in Iraq.
A cash machine so you can get money out of a hole in the wall.
Absolutely correct. A cash machine, you put your card, you put your PIN code, and then and you get your money.
That's something of a revolution here, isn't it? Because this is a cash economy.
My friend, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step.
He's not the only guy who's looking on the bright side. This man's selling paint.
I am optimistic because I expect that the media show only the black picture on Iraq. This is not the reality. If you talk only in Baghdad, some bombing and so, they show only this. But they don't show that we are 25 million population. There is building, there is factory, there is life. They don't show this.
If you want to make a fashion statement in this part of the world, forget Gucci shoes or Armani suits. Get yourself some designer security gear.
Yes, as you can see, most of the equipment is bulletproof jackets designed for the army. At the end, you will see jackets for VIPs. You look at it, you think it's an Italian designer. It's called the Gold and Platinum Edition. These are made out of suede.
And how have they been selling?
Well, pretty good.
So in today's Iraq, this is a boom product.
In fact, it is, especially in Baghdad.
You can't build a vibrant Iraq just from selling flak jackets. It takes investment. And the $18 billion US reconstruction program has run its course. The funds had to be allocated by the end of September. So what happens next? Congressman Henry Waxman says the politicians here in Washington are in no mood to stump up large sums of new money.
I don't know the answer to what happens now. We've spent the money that's been allocated for reconstruction. We have a lot of embarrassment over our reconstruction efforts. I don't hear anybody clamoring for putting more money into Iraq reconstruction. And I can't live with the idea that we're going to pour more money, good money after bad, or more lives, which will be good lives after those that have already been lost.
So that's your verdict on reconstruction, good money thrown after bad?
Well, we've taken a lot of good money and wasted it. I don't think we ought to put any more money or lives to waste any further.
Increasingly, it will be up to Iraqis to manage their own reconstruction. But it's hard to see how they can do this while government is in such chaos. That, at least, is the view of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, Stuart Bowen. He's spent the last couple of years reporting to Congress on how American money has been spent. Now, he says, attention should be paid to Iraqi government corruption.
I call it the second insurgency. This money that's stolen doesn't merely enrich criminals, but frequently goes out to fund criminal militias or insurgents. And that means lost lives for U.S. troops.
Stuart Bowen reckons corruption in government is costing Iraq about $4 billion a year, over 10% of its national income. And he points to another, yet more serious problem. Even if money isn't stolen, Iraqi ministries lack the skills and competence to spend funds effectively.
That's the most significant question facing the Iraq program now. Capacity building is a huge question mark. The estimates are that $8 to $10 billion of Iraq's budget will go unspent because of that lack of capacity to spend that money. By that I mean that the Iraq ministries are able to pay their salaries, to pay for their administrative costs, but beyond that, their capacities are limited.
The $18 billion U.S. aid program, the major tranche of American reconstruction spending, is widely seen as a failure. Now it's over. But David Nash, who ran the scheme in its early stages, says the critics are wrong.
If we did an $18.4 billion construction program in your country and we ended up with 2,200 major projects being completed in 3 years, I think we'd be heroes. I've been very proud of what's happened. There's been a lot of people that have gone over there from all countries and have done their very best and have been shot at, just like I was, and mortared and bombed and everything else. But they've stayed in there despite all this criticism, including contractors. And what I say to other people who criticize us at great length, I always ask them, well, where were you when we needed help? Where were you?
The mood here in Washington is moving towards disengagement. In real terms, the U.S. has invested twice as much money rebuilding Iraq as it spent reviving Germany under the Marshall Plan after World War II. Germany was transformed, but in Iraq there's little to show for it. Why? Profiteering, corruption, bad management, and the strength of the insurgency have all played a part. But above all, there was a woeful lack of planning. Policymakers were left making it up as they went along.
The Baghdad Billions was presented by Mark Gregory. The producer was David Edmonds.